This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live March 25th, 2012. And we're going to be talking about the internet today, the digital revolution in politics. We're going to have as our guest the author of an extraordinary new book on what's taking place around the world and in the United States with political activism and the internet, the threats to the internet being a democratic source agency and possibly even being a regressive agency, and the great political fights in front of us. It's going to be a great hour. I hope you'll join us. But before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey. Verizon has joined forces with a cadre of cable companies, including Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and Cox, in a controversial deal that would divide up the broadband market. Verizon is vying to buy $3.6 billion in unused spectrum from the cable companies to expand its own network. Giving up the spectrum means cable companies will back away from investing in the wireless market. In return, Verizon has agreed to lay off of cable companies' turf by not building out residential broadband fiber networks. Josh Levy, the internet campaign director for Free Press, said the companies should be rivals, but instead are helping each other corner their respective markets.
Verizon won't compete with the cable companies anymore, and the cable companies won't compete with Verizon anymore. It's kind of like the five families of The Godfather getting together and dividing up territory. This is pretty much what Verizon and these cable companies have done.
In addition, the companies have proposed a cross-marketing agreement to sell each other's services to their customers, further solidifying their dominance. Verizon is already the leading wireless provider in the country. Levy said the deal is bad news for the public because it would stifle competition.
So if you live in a community that has one cable broadband provider and you've been hoping that a company like Verizon would come in and build a high-speed fiber optic network, your hopes are going to be dashed. It's not going to do that anymore. You are going to be stuck with that cable provider. And that cable provider might not be willing to build out into underserved areas. It might not be willing to provide prices that are affordable for all residents. And so a lot of people who have been stuck with inadequate access or no access are still going to be stuck.
The deal has already raised eyebrows in Congress. The Senate Antitrust Subcommittee has held a hearing this week to discuss the deal. And the Federal Communications Commission asked the companies to submit further details on the arrangement. Levy said public outrage is growing against the deal.
Big broadband companies like Verizon, like AT&T in the past, rather than try to innovate and serve customers through better service and better pricing, instead make these power grabs. They can own even more of the market, charge us even more, and get around the need to provide better service and greater choice.
To learn more, visit savetheinternet.com.
Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index says that crackdown was the word of the year in 2011. Never have journalists, through their reporting, vexed the enemies of freedom so much. Never have acts of censorship and physical attacks on journalists seemed so numerous. With the warmer weather will likely come more Occupy protests and more journalists trying to get the story. But this spring, any surge in abusive tactics against journalists will be met with a renewed effort to protect the First Amendment and support the rights of both mainstream and citizen journalists to report on the protests. Free Press created an audio piece as a message from our members to journalists.
I'm Josh Stearns, Journalism and Public Media Campaign Director at Free Press. When we asked our members to stand with the nearly 70 journalists who've been arrested covering Occupy Wall Street protests, the response was profound. More than 40,000 people wrote letters and called their mayors to demand that they uphold the First Amendment. What follows are just a few of the comments our members sent in.
Friends in the journalist community, thank you for your commitment to getting the story, the truth, as close as possible, and bringing it to us, the public. I'm shocked that you are victims of this violation of your rights by those who are willing to violate our laws and erode our Constitution.
Please keep doing what you're doing. We all know the arrests are wrong, but your work is so important to democracy. We can't have it without you.
Freedom of the press is one of the first and most important notions of the founding of our country. It is not possible to have democracy without it. And as in earlier years, the press extends to anyone reporting, not just those employed by the major outlets.
Do not be discouraged by the outrageous actions of politicians who cannot stand the heat and violate our First Amendment rights. Americans are watching, and we are standing behind you because we know that our freedom depends on your accurate reporting.
I was born into journalism. My father and uncle owned newspapers all their lives. I'm livid at the freewheeling of law enforcement that tramples over the rights of the people by arresting journalists. That supposedly only happens in countries without a constitution like ours.
Your courage in reporting, regardless of the consequences, is amazing. Thank you for doing your job. Now it's our turn to try to help you obtain your freedom. Stay strong.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, March 25th, 2012. Our guest today is Rebecca McKinnon. She is the author of the brand new book that has just come out from Basic Books, Consent of the Governed, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom, which I've had the privilege of reading over the past few weeks. Rebecca McKinnon was a former CNN correspondent, is now an internet policy expert at the New America Foundation. She's joining us on the phones today. Rebecca, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks very much, Bob. Just one quick thing. The title of the book is Consent of the Network.
Of the Network. Excuse me. I had it covered up, but I wrote it down wrong. Thank you.
The Network was John Locke.
That's right. Yeah. He beat you on that one. Consent of the Network. Excuse me for that. Well, Rebecca, let's start, if we can, with just I was just watching the news this weekend, and there were a bunch of people talking about the Trayvon Martin murder in Florida, and they were going on about how the social media played such a central role in building this case, drawing people's attention to it, and sort of getting around the fact that it really hadn't been covered much in the news media. And then finally, the news media picked up on it weeks after social media had been beating the drum. And the logical connection here was to Arab Spring, to the Occupy movement, the other protests and demonstrations around the world and in the United States and places like Wisconsin, and the critical role social media has seemingly played in making these and giving people more power. And your book sort of says, okay, yeah, there's something to that, but that's not the whole story. Could you explain?
Sure. Well, it's absolutely true. I mean, the public square, our politics are increasingly reliant on social media, and it's a really great thing that, you know, in the past, if a journalist, if a news organization didn't want to cover something, everybody was pretty much out of luck. Now we can take matters into our own hands and cover issues and bring attention to issues that we think are important for our communities, for our country, for our world, and that's really, really important. But there are some things we need to be thinking about as we become increasingly reliant on the internet, on mobile devices, for our politics, for just the kind of activism we want to be able to do in order to fight for our rights. And that is that, you know, as we're dependent on these platforms, the whole issue is what you can and cannot do with these platforms is due to decisions being made by companies, based on commercial considerations and by various government regulators in terms of how these services can work, who can have access to them, what the rules of the road are, and this ends up affecting how you can use them. So not only are we users of these tools, which are very empowering, but we're also citizens of these digital spaces. And just as with our physical spaces, if you don't fight for your rights within your physical communities to make sure that your community is structured in a way that, you know, minority and unpopular speech has a place, we need to make sure that remains the case in our cell phone networks, on social media platforms, and on the internet more generally, because we've been seeing a number of cases where, you know, if you have no expectation of privacy and you're using the internet to engage in activism against police brutality, say, and you're concerned about surveillance by the police that might be unconstrained, that's a problem. And so what are the connections between the companies running these services and government agencies? How do we make sure that power that's being exercised across digital networks remains accountable, that when it's abused, that that the abusers are held accountable, and that people understand how power over our digital lives is being shaped?
Our guest, Rebecca McKinnon, author of the new book, Consent of the Networked. We're talking about it today on Media Matters. And, you know, one of the things that's striking in your book, and I want to go through a number of the examples you give because it's so important, is that it's not just the good guys who can use these technologies. The bad guys have a lot of influence over them as well, or it may be bad guys, but just powerful institutions that are self-interested. And, you know, you talk about Arab Spring, for example, the governments of Tunisia and Egypt, and also, for that matter, Iran. And, you know, they have ways of, you know, they aren't powerless, I guess, is the point you make in the book, against the threat of social media.
Well, they're not entirely powerless. It sort of depends on how they deal with the situation, what they anticipate, and how they manipulate the situation. So, for instance, let's take Egypt. So Egypt did not censor the internet very much before Mubarak, the dictator, was forced out. And that was one of the reasons why people were able to use Facebook and social media to organize against a regime that they felt was very repressive in a lot of other ways. But now that Mubarak is gone, the activists who use social media have found, people discovered a few months after Mubarak stepped down, that the security forces had been surveilling the internet in a very detailed way. People actually were able to gain access to some of the intelligence facilities right after Mubarak stepped down, and they found files that were full of email transcripts, their cell phone text messages, and so on. The authorities had been keeping detailed records of activist movements online and on the cell phone networks, and people in Egypt today assume that the transitional military government is still doing that, and so that they realize that while they're able to use the networks to organize, the government is also watching what they're doing and then can act to stop people before arrest people after the fact and so on. And so that ends up kind of working in the authorities' favor when people are fearful that they're being subject to surveillance without any kind of constraint. So that's just one kind of example. You also see in places like China where the government has just decided to block global social media platforms, but they've encouraged the development of local internet services. So there's a lot of Chinese social media companies, Chinese search engines, Chinese chat forums, and so on, that exist on the Chinese internet, and all of those companies are required to conduct a great deal of censorship and surveillance on the government's behalf. And what that means is that while there's a lot of lively discussion in China, and there is actually some local community activism and anti-corruption movements and so on, you're not able to use the internet to form an opposition party because the local companies will assist the government in helping to kind of track down who the instigators are before anything gets very big. And so governments are able to, you know, depending on the relationship that companies have with governments, you know, it can play out in a lot of different ways.
And, you know, the book has a long discussion of how China has dealt with the internet, the threat of the internet, and the possibilities of the internet. And you worked in China, and you're fluent in Chinese, so that makes the section that much stronger in my mind. And it was really striking to me because the internet's coming to play a huge role in the Chinese economy, and they really can't proceed without the internet and be an effective economic player. But as I read your chapter and your discussion of China, I was struck at sort of the multi-layers and the sophistication of their system, such that it wasn't like your Orwellian darkness at noon approach. That really was struck me as a highly sophisticated way to basically get the result you want.
That's right. I mean, people feel a lot freer on the internet in China than people felt before the internet. There's a lot more discussion, a lot more information available in China than ever before. So people feel like it's improving, but you do not have absolute protection for your rights. If you write a treatise calling for multi-party democracy or calling for Arab Spring-like demonstrations to call for an end to one-party rule, you will go to jail. You know, your rights are not protected. Yet the government also uses the internet to interact with the citizens, to find out what the problems are, to address problems. And so it does also kind of use the internet as a focus group in a way, and also as a steam valve to enable people to blow off steam and be able to address problems without actually having to give up power.
I read the book a few weeks ago, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, but as I recall, even something like the Tiananmen Square uprising of 1989 and massacre, which is so indelibly inscribed, I think, in the minds of people outside of China to think about modern Chinese politics, that's not really a landmark historical moment for young Chinese today.
Yeah, well, you have the internet generation. You know, you have people who are now, you know, basically adults who were born after the crackdown or who were very small when it happened, and they've heard very little about it. They know very little about it because it's kind of been erased not only from the media, but also from the internet. It's not possible to find much information about it on the Chinese internet because Chinese internet companies have to keep these things off.
Our guest today on Media Matters, you've just been listening to Rebecca McKinnon, author of the new book just published by Basic Books, Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom. The phone lines are open. This is a live show, so please call in at 217-333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Rebecca McKinnon was one time a foreign correspondent for CNN and also is now an internet policy expert at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C. The book is all-encompassing. It's a global presentation you make, and you certainly are not making the case that the U.S. is in a white hat and all these other governments are in black hats. To the contrary, you provide a fairly strong critique of the United States in the book, especially, not exclusively, but especially when it comes to the war on terrorism, national security, and how this is affecting internet freedom.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we have a problem, I think, throughout the democratic world where there are, you know, serious problems that have arisen in the internet age when it comes to the use of the internet by terrorists, the use of the internet by pedophiles, the use of the internet by all kinds of criminals. And, of course, there needs to be solutions. This needs to be addressed. There needs to be some governance to fight crime. And, of course, constituents in democratic societies are calling on our leaders to do something about these problems and to make us safe. But just as in our physical world, you know, there are trade-offs. You can have 100% security or you could be 100% crime-free in New York City, but at what cost? You know, and what way are you going to do it? And since the beginning of our country, and you know, I think all democracies grapple with this, is how do you balance security and liberty? And with the internet, I think a lot of times you get people calling for solutions to problems, thinking they can just totally fix the problem because they see it as a technical problem. But the problem is that it's social and political online just like it is offline. And if you're going to give the government free rein to access people, you know, customers and users' private information on corporate networks, you know, there's going to be some cost to liberties. And so how are we going to balance those trade-offs? How are we going to make sure that when power over networks is abused, when power of access is abused against citizens in ways that makes them fearful, that makes dissent less possible, that there are consequences for the people abusing power, and that we even have a way of knowing that the abuses are happening.
Yeah, you talk in the book at some length about the, not the great length, but some length, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, I think it's called.
Right.
Can you explain that to our listeners and why that's important for the Internet, why you mentioned it in the book?
Right. Well, I talk about it in the book because, you know, basically what this act does is that if a company assists the U.S. government in conducting surveillance, that is actually illegal and unconstitutional, that company is completely absolved of any legal responsibility. They are not liable in any way. So if a company, and this happened in a case with AT&T under the Bush administration, where the NSA had kind of built a room in a facility in San Francisco, and it turned out that some whistleblowers confirmed this had been going on in other locations, that was siphoning off basically all traffic going through that facility, which obviously included the traffic of many American citizens that were not under investigation or suspected of any crime or anything. And despite this being completely illegal, nobody could sue AT&T. That efforts to take class action lawsuits against them were thrown out because AT&T had no liability under this law. And so this is what I mean by, yes, we do need to be able to have law enforcement. There are serious problems and threats on the Internet, but if people who abuse their power over our digital lives are completely unaccountable, then that is very, very troubling. That is very, very corrosive, I think, of democracy.
Rebecca McKinnon, what about the WikiLeaks scandal? You write a little bit about that. How does this fit into the consent of the network, to the whole global struggle for Internet freedom?
Sure. Well, you know, the WikiLeaks case is very complicated, and I'm going to put sort of Julian Assange aside, and I'm going to put Bradley Manning aside, and talk about sort of the First Amendment free speech part of WikiLeaks, the WikiLeaks case, which is that you saw a situation where in the United States, WikiLeaks has never been charged with a crime. I'm talking about WikiLeaks, the website,
mm-hmm.
WikiLeaks, the organization. It has never been charged with a crime in the United States, let alone convicted of anything. Yet you had a situation where Amazon Web Hosting, which had been their web host at the time when the initial diplomatic cables were released, dropped them as a client, and they could, because according to your private terms of service on Amazon and most of these other services, clients can be dropped really for any reason. The First Amendment rights do not apply. So what you have happening is that because there was a lot of political pressure on Amazon, because you had Senator Joseph Lieberman sort of saying that Amazon should not be hosting WikiLeaks. You had a number of American politicians saying things, about WikiLeaks being a criminal thing. You also had an opinion being issued by the legal advisor of the State Department saying that in the State Department's opinion, a crime was taking place, although, again, no charges have been brought. No case has actually been brought. That was enough to cause not only Amazon to drop WikiLeaks as a client, but for payment processing services, the credit card services, PayPal, and so on, to say, you know, this is just too controversial. We don't want to serve this client that is purveying controversial speech, even though there may well be a good case that it's protected under the First Amendment, but we don't want to go there. And so that's troubling in a time when increasingly the public sphere is dependent on these privately owned and operated networks that all have terms of service where they say, you know, we reserve the right to discontinue our relationship with you as a client at any time. You know, they're not required to respect the First Amendment rights of their users. And you see this in other cases that are a lot more subtle and less politically inflammatory. You see, for instance, with Apple and its apps in the iPhone and iPad store, there have been a number of cases of political satirists. There was a guy named Mark Fiore who eventually won a Pulitzer Prize for his political cartoons, and he had an app that he submitted to the iPhone, to the iPad, iPhone, Apple App Store, and it was not approved because it was considered offensive. And of course, political satire generally offends somebody. That's because it's satire, and it's very, very much First Amendment protected speech. It's very much part of our political discourse. But you're seeing, actually, on a lot of these privately run platforms, satire being kept off to some degree because it's considered offensive to various customers. And so that's just another example of how you have private platforms, private operators, making judgments about what's appropriate for their customer base based on their own commercial considerations that in various ways can be corrosive of the public sphere if our public discourse is increasingly dependent on these services.
Well, it also seems, as I listened to you talk, Rebecca McKinnon, as I read your book, that the problem is exponentially greater because there are these handful of enormous monopolies, really, for lack of a better term.
That's right.
That dominate these huge spheres of digital life, so that it just takes two or three of them to say no, and you're basically squeezed out. It's not like there's 1,000 firms that can provide the same service to you.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And in a world where, you know, Facebook is increasingly trying to become sort of the universal way that you log into everything on the internet, if you want to post a comment on some news sites, you know, they want you to log in through your Facebook and so on. And Facebook has terms of service where they say you have to use your real name, and you can lose your account if somebody challenges whether you're using your real name or not. And there are plenty of people out there, particularly who are political activists, not only in places like Syria and Iran, but even in this country, who actually, you know, are put at risk if they use their real name in some cases. And so you end up having a situation where if you're in a position where you can't afford to use your real name, let's say you want to participate in a movement that would further the rights, let's say gay marriage or something, and you want to participate in that discussion online, but you know you don't want your employer to know your sexual preference. If you're being forced to use your real name through these services in order to participate in discussions or in order to participate in activism, that's a problem, even in this country. So there are, you know, as we're increasingly dependent on these services that are making decisions about how your identity should be manifested, what information about you is private and what is public, and we're increasingly, you know, if you're an activist and you want to reach a wide audience, you have to use Facebook whether or not you like its terms, because otherwise you're not going to reach the people you want to reach. You know, that's troubling.
Our guest today, you've just been listening to, Rebecca McKinnon, author of the new book, Consent of the Networked, the Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom, just published by Basic Books. The phone lines are open here at Media Matters, 217-333-9455, or the toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. In the book, Rebecca McKinnon, and we've just barely touched the surface of what's in this book, but in the book, you go into some detail about these big companies, the power they have, and some of the problems that pose us. But you also do a nice job, I think, of talking about the notion of the digital commons and the origins and the evolution of the Internet to the current state, and how important the notion of a digital commons was to get the Internet even moving and being successful in the first place, so these firms would have something to monopolize.
That's absolutely right, that you know, the standards and protocols that the Internet is built on are open standards. You know, you don't have to pay somebody to use them. The World Wide Web, which is, you know, based on a basically computer language that was invented by a guy named Tim Berners-Lee in the late 80s, you know, the World Wide Web wouldn't exist if he hadn't decided to make this computer language called HTML free for everybody to use. I mean, imagine if you had to pay to buy a suite of HTML coding software every time you wanted to create a web page. We wouldn't have the same kind of World Wide Web we have today.
In fact, if I can just interject for a second, Rebecca McKinnon, Berners-Lee in his writings has said that, you know, it would be impossible to do something like the World Wide Web today with the myriad of patent and trademark and copyright infringements you'd have to run through.
Yeah, that's probably true, and I think that's telling. And it's not to say that, okay, everything should be free, we should have absolutely no copyright, nobody should get paid for anything. I don't think that's the argument, but the argument is rather how do we achieve a balance, and that there are a lot of people actually who are creating content, creating services, creating software that they're seeking to do for reasons that aren't totally commercial, that have other purposes, they're trying to create a broader platform on which commercial activity can thrive, but the platform itself may be just, you know, creating a public good. And so just making sure that remains possible is extremely important, because Google, Facebook, a lot of the major internet companies that exist today actually rely a great deal on open software and open standards. And activists, particularly, if you talk to a lot of the key internet activists around the Middle East, they'll tell you that a lot of them are using open source software platforms to run their websites and open source web hosting services because they can't afford the proprietary ones. And so this is really helping to support a great deal of the kind of civil society activity, citizen activity, that has made the Arab Spring possible. And, of course, you know, platforms like Wikipedia and so on, this is all part of the digital commons, people who are incentivized for various reasons to contribute to sort of common knowledge, common technical resources.
When I was reading your book, Rebecca McKinnon, I also was looking at another book simultaneously, and it resonated because you make a strong argument about the power of companies like Google and Facebook internationally now with these sort of systems that people have to be involved in. In another book that's come out simultaneous to yours is by a business writer named David Rothkopf called Power Inc. Mm-hmm. And in the book, he argues that most of the governments in the world, not the richest countries, but 80% of the governments in the world really have very little power left over their polity. That most of the power has now gone to corporations, huge corporations, and specifically corporations like Facebook and Google. And that really, in a way, complemented the point I think you were trying to make about how these are companies now with foreign policies.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And you know, I think Rothkopf talks as well about, you know, the multinational oil companies and lots of other companies that are becoming much more powerful in the global economy and global geopolitics than small countries. And this is why we have what's come to be known as a corporate social responsibility movement, which is to say that because these corporations do have so much power over people's lives, ultimately over people's political freedoms, whether or not they set out to influence people's political freedoms, the fact is that they do, and so they have responsibilities. And just as companies have a responsibility, and I think everybody is pretty much agreed that companies have a responsibility not to render our air unbreathable or our water undrinkable, and to conduct their business in a way that's sustainable for the broader environment, for the broader health of the communities that they exist in. Similarly, we need to insist that companies recognize the impact and power that they have on our political lives, and recognize that they have responsibilities Because otherwise, even though, you know, many of these technology platforms are quite empowering, you know, we're able to kind of rise up and say no, but are we going to really be able to use them to build sustainable democracies in a way in which we're not manipulated and not subject to surveillance? That's much less clear.
There's so much I want to talk about. You talked about self-regulation there. At the end of the book is filled with ideas for how to protect and promote democratic freedoms in the Internet era, in the United States and globally. And self-regulation is one of the options. So what else do you think citizens need to do to protect and promote freedom on the Internet?
Well, I think there's a range of things. I think, first of all, it's just becoming aware. You are a citizen of the Internet. You are a netizen. You're not just a passive user. And if you don't like what your Internet service provider is doing or how your iPad is run, you need to let these companies know. You need to exercise your power as a consumer. We also have, many of us, power as investors. More and more people are putting their pension money or their investments into socially responsible investment funds. And more of these funds are screening companies not only for their environmental and labor practices, but also for free expression and privacy. And so we do have power as investors. We should be calling out, you know, the early stage investors that are investing in companies that are having a negative impact on people's freedoms. We need to be demanding more transparency, I think, in our laws as well as in corporate practices in terms of what kinds of information companies are handing over to government agencies around the world. What kinds of demands are being made for censorship by governments to companies around the world? We need to demand reporting and transparency both from companies and governments on this so we know who to hold accountable when abuses happen. We need to be more engaged as voters in our own country and voters around the world in places where there is meaningful democracy. And I think we saw this begin to happen earlier this year with the Stop Online Piracy Act, where a lot of American voters said, hey, you know, this legislation that had been proposed in Congress to protect copyright went too far because the solution proposed involved surveillance and censorship. And a lot of people, you know, called their elected representatives and said, no, we don't want this legislation. So part of it is just being aware of what's going on. There are a bunch of cybersecurity bills in Congress that have troubling surveillance components, and the public is not really engaged on these issues. We're not asking our presidential, let alone our Senate and House of Representatives candidates, where they stand on these things.
One of the points you make, Rebecca McKinnon, in the book is that these aren't issues that tend to get a lot of news coverage. They aren't covered in the news media. I guess to the extent they are, they're covered in the business press as issues of concern to investors and managers, but not as political issues of interest to citizens. And where would you, for listeners listening to this program, people who read your book, where would you recommend they turn if they want to be more abreast of the developments in these in Internet policy area?
Well, that's a really good question. There are a lot of fairly specialized or more specialized publications that are starting to cover these things well. Wired does some coverage. There's an online publication called Ars Technica that has some good journalists who are covering these issues. The Wall Street Journal actually has been doing quite a bit of good coverage on, particularly on privacy and surveillance matters. There's a online publication, again, called ZDNet and a sister publication called CNET that have some good reporting on rights-related issues. But you have to kind of look around for it. I'm actually involved with one project called Global Voices Advocacy, which is a sister project of this Global Voices citizen media community that I started a few years ago, where once every 2 weeks we're putting together something called the Netizen Report, where we're basically compiling a lot of links to a lot of stories that relate to these power struggles on the internet, and we're hoping to kind of ramp up more coverage on these issues. So you do have to look around for it, and this is indeed one of the problems that news media generally don't view the internet as a politically contested space. They view it as a business or a gadget story, but hopefully that'll change.
Rebecca McKinnon, our guest, author of the new book, Consent of the Networked. Excuse me, I did it again. Consent of the Networked, The Worldwide Struggle for Internet Freedom, just published by Basic Books. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. We're live on WILL AM 580. The phone lines are open at 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. One of the things, Rebecca McKinnon, that was really interesting in the book that you talked about a little bit towards the end, that I think is one of the most interesting political developments of the last few years, is these new pirate parties, like the one in Berlin, that got a fairly significant percentage of the vote in their municipal elections last year, I believe it was. And can you talk a little bit about this phenomenon? Because I don't think many Americans have seen anything like that.
Sure, yeah. Well, I think this also relates to, you know, the fact that in Europe, the political systems there are parliamentary systems rather than the kind of system we have here, and so you have a lot more than just two parties. And, you know, a generation ago, you saw the Green Party emerge, you know, out of the environmental movement to become a much broader set of parties across Europe, primarily, that were pushing for kind of not only sort of labor rights but sustainable practices. And I think these pirate parties are sort of the next generation of people, and while they're called pirate parties, basically because I think their origin came with people who were worried that governments were going to start censoring in the name of copyright protection. But these pirate parties are gaining broader appeal because they're really turning themselves into anti-censorship, anti-surveillance platforms. And there are a lot of young people in Europe, as there are, I think, around the world, who are really concerned both about censorship and surveillance and the way in which both government and corporate power are exercised over people's lives. And these parties are trying to advocate particularly on these issues and starting to get votes. And so I think it's kind of like the new Greens in a way. But in the United States, of course, we've got this two-party system, and sort of efforts to create a Green Party have not worked so well. So I don't know if we'll see much of a spread of the Pirate Party in the United States, but I do hope that just as, you know, two generations ago, labor issues became a major factor in political platforms, and then a generation ago, environmental issues became a major component of people's political platforms in this country. I hope that with this generation, we're going to see internet rights and liberties as a major part of people's political platforms in this country, because there are a lot of voters, I think, who increasingly are concerned about this issue.
Our guest, Rebecca McKinnon, let's go to the phone lines now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Yes, I agree with much of what you had to say about people needing to become more informed about what's going on the internet, and also about the effect that corporations have on limiting the conversations that are going on. But I am concerned about, perhaps in some ways it's a technical distinction, but the fact that you use the term First Amendment to refer to the way that corporations are limiting speech, because, and I see this happening on the right as well with the recent Rush Limbaugh controversy, it seems to me that when advertisers removed their support for Rush Limbaugh and people complained that they were trying to take away his First Amendment freedom, similarly, if a company decides to not provide a website for WikiLeaks, since the First Amendment is only there to prevent the government from taking action to limit speech, I don't see how either of those cases, since the government was not involved in limiting the speech, I don't see how those are cases for First Amendment actions or prohibitions. Could you comment?
Thank you very much, caller. Rebecca McKinnon?
Yeah, that's a really, really, I think, important question you raise. And this is why these issues, I think, are so tough, because you're absolutely right that the First Amendment is only supposed to deal with government action. But we've now reached a time where I think the framers of the Constitution and the way our system was set up didn't anticipate the extent to which our public discourse would be so reliant on these virtual, privately run spaces. And the power that these private, virtually run digital spaces, privately run digital spaces have over political outcomes and over people's ability to speak out and get heard, and how we deal with that. So it is, I think, something that we need to figure out in terms of how does the law address it constitutionally, how do we address it. But I am concerned that the status quo as it currently stands, if we do nothing about it, or if we place no responsibility on companies towards citizens' free speech rights, when citizens are relying on these companies for their public discourse, the end result is going to be a narrowing and chilling of our public debates.
You know, Rebecca, if I can just add in a word there, the Supreme Court actually did rule on this issue in 1945 in one of probably its most famous freedom of the press case, the Associated Press versus the USA. And in his majority opinion, Justice Hugo Black wrote that the government has a distinct interest in preventing monopoly in communication. That was a dire threat to freedom of speech and freedom of the press. So that is, you know, that's understood as sort of implicit. It doesn't mean you censor commercial media, but it means you have a right to set up a system that doesn't allow monopoly in commercial media.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest, Rebecca McKinnon, author of the new book, Consent of the Networked. Let's now go to line two, Champaign County. You're on the air.
Yeah, I don't know how much you've treated this or whether you're thinking about this, but I thought I'd throw it out, and that's data mining corporations. I mean, a lot of people surrender a lot of their information voluntarily, knowingly or unknowingly, I guess, in a way. But do you have anything to say about, you know, this proliferation of data mining private corporations that then get hired by the government to it's sort of like a cutout, basically. And I don't know. I'm concerned about one that's local here, SAIC.
Well, you know, caller, let me add on if I can. This is a great question. It's one I was about to ask. We had as our guest on the show last week, Joseph Turow, the University of Pennsylvania professor, who just wrote a book called The Daily U, published by Yale University Press. And Professor Turow talks about the emergence of this data collection online for commercial purposes, that advertising online is built on getting immense amounts of data about people, far beyond what we're used to, and that there's the threat, as you point out in the book, that this will merge with government interest in collecting data on people. And that so it gets to this whole question of all this information that's out there. And how does this get in the way of having a free society when you really have no privacy and people know stuff about you that might not be up to have your best interest at heart?
Yeah, well, this is absolutely a concern, and this is why we need to get privacy policies and you know, to the extent that we regulate to get it right. I'm not in favor of over-regulating, but yet at the same time, that we do have a problem where so much information is being collected by people, as the caller said. A lot of times people don't realize how it's being collected together and then sold, and then how it can then be used by government, which is one client of these companies. And this is all part of the whole issue of, yes, we're giving up information ourselves, often willingly, for the sake of convenience, for the sake of services we want, but we don't have a very good idea of what's happening to that information, how that's going to affect us later on. People do need to be more informed. We need better press coverage of what's going on. We need to require companies to be much more transparent about what they're doing. We need much more transparency around what governments are doing with this information and how they're collecting it, who they're obtaining it from. so that we can hold abuse accountable. And right now, people just have so little information about what's going on. They're sort of throwing up their hands and sort of giving up, which is very dangerous. Because I think if we do end up in a kind of society, you know, the old notion of the panopticon, where you know, you don't have to have everybody under surveillance all the time. You just have to have enough people under surveillance arbitrarily enough of the time that everybody just assumes that nothing they're doing is private, and that has a really chilling effect on vulnerable communities, people who are trying to get justice when they feel that the system is against them. It's going to chill our democracy at the edges. If Bob, if there's time, I want to just repeat one quote that
I
put in the book from the beginning of part three. Which is titled Democracy's Challenges, where I quote Alexis de Tocqueville, where he said in 1840, if despotism were to be established amongst the democratic nations of our days, it might assume a different character. It would be more extensive and more mild. It would degrade men without tormenting them. And this is, I think, the concern. It's not that we're going to suddenly turn into China or Syria, but just over time, our freedoms are going to be degraded, that kind of fear of consequences creeps in, and dissent becomes less possible and less effective.
Let's go back to the phone lines now to our next caller. Line 3, Loda, you're on the air with Rebecca McKinnon.
Hi, I'm thoroughly enjoying this conversation. I just wanted to throw out one more thing with the First Amendment rights and your thought of the despotism and people, you know, keeping track of everything is, I understand that it's becoming more popular now for companies and educational institutions to require their prospective employees or their students to friend someone on the staff so that they can keep track of things that are posted by this student or this employee on Facebook and Twitter. And these are, you know, if you want to be at this institution or if you want to work for this company, you give up the right for personal, only amongst your friends, communication by these social medias. And that's all I had to say. Thanks so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you very much, caller. Rebecca McKinnon?
Yeah, well, you know, interestingly, Facebook is actually starting to lobby Congress for legislation that would forbid employers from requiring people to hand over their Facebook passwords, because I think they're starting to realize there's a danger that if people have absolutely no control over their own social network, and if it basically is turned into your public network by default because employers and educators are requiring it, then the whole thing is going to completely lose value. Then you might as well just be doing a public blog the whole time, you know, because you can't control your information relationships in any way. And, you know, so this is the problem. And this kind of conflicts in a way with Facebook's insistence on requiring people in the terms of service to use their real names and not being able to use pseudonyms or alternative identities without risking getting kicked off the platform.
Rebecca McKinnon, our guest today. We've only got a few minutes left, and there's a lot of ground I want to cover, but one issue I do want to get to is the issue of network neutrality, which you talk about in the book. I don't know if you had a chance to hear the Media Minutes newscast right before we went on air while you were on hold, Rebecca, but you know, right now the access to the ISP world is broken down into the wireline old phone companies. You know, they are now the wireless companies, AT&T and Verizon, and the cable company, Comcast, basically, which has the wireline dominating that market. And they're sort of working up a deal where they're carving up the pie so they won't compete with each other as much and protecting their own turf. And this really gets to some of the great concerns you have, because these are the people that literally have ultimately direct control over who gets access and who doesn't. And the issue of network neutrality. Can you talk about that issue and where that stands, not just here, but also in other countries?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's one of these really tough issues because, you know, people who are opposed to net neutrality say, well, you know, we don't want the governments regulating internet companies. Yet at the same time, there is a problem where if you just allow an internet service provider to discriminate between different kinds of traffic on the network. So, for instance, if you have a completely unneutral situation, you could have your ISP allow YouTube videos to run much faster and be much more accessible than, you know, the YouTube's the videos that are hosted by somebody's homemade website, because YouTube maybe does a deal with that ISP, and so that you would have kind of uneven access to different services depending on what that ISP thinks is advantageous to it, which can lead to situations where commercial material is much more easily accessible than non-commercial material, for instance. Or, you know, an ISP could, favor services that it has commercial relationships with and kind of downgrade services it has no commercial relationships with. And that has real implications for free speech, particularly when you have a lot of nonprofit groups and activist groups, you know, that are running non-commercial internet services that don't have deals. And in this country, I mean, right now the FCC rules are requiring neutrality on the fixed line internet. So, you know, if your Comcast that goes into your house or whatever it is required to basically be neutral. But when it comes to mobile services, there's a lot less neutrality required, in part because, you know, the carriers argue that, well, they just can't control the bandwidth. There's just, you know, it's a much more scarce kind of bandwidth situation. But on the other hand, if you don't require neutrality on mobile devices in a situation where more and more people are relying on their mobile devices, their smartphones, as their only internet connection, particularly in poorer communities where people don't have internet at home, their only internet outside of school or work might be on their phone. And if that phone carrier, and this happens sometimes where the phone carrier will have a deal with certain online video services and not others, so that you can access certain video services more cheaply than others, then, you know, that affects your ability to get alternative information that's not being hosted on the favored services. And you see this happening a lot, actually more in the developing world, where, so for instance, there's something called Facebook Zero that is available in a number of developing countries, which is basically, if you're on a mobile smartphone in certain countries, you can get onto Facebook for free. But if you want to get on, I don't know, freepress.com or, you know, some activist website or, you know, some other website that doesn't have a deal with the mobile carrier, you're paying a per megabit fee that's quite high. So that's going to drive you to do all your kind of online publishing, all your online activism, all your online information gathering through Facebook because it's cheaper.
This is at, what sort of countries is this taking place in?
Well, I don't have the list in front of me, but...
But there are several.
Yeah, there's a number in the Middle East, South Asia, so on.
Well, those are the joys of being a monopoly.
Africa,
that's all I can
also
say.
Yeah.
Rebecca McKinnon, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Thank you so much for taking time out of your Sunday to join us to talk about your book, Consent of the Networked.
Well, thank you for your interest.
Of course. And I want to thank Kyle Kroha for engineering the show. Christina Williams, as always, my producer. And I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours. Until then, everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
We should see partly sunny skies the rest of the way today in Champaign-Urbana with the high in the low 70s. Tonight, partly cloudy with the low in the low 40s. On Monday, partly sunny but cooler with a high only in the upper 50s. Monday night, mostly cloudy, low in the low 40s. And Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high in the low 70s. There's a chance for showers and thunderstorms Tuesday night, then clear conditions expected Wednesday and Thursday. This is WILL 5.